I work, as Martin said, among the Northern MAGA, like Mark Opitz, who presented in his paper yesterday morning and who provided an excellent introduction to the corpus of shamanic songs. So I'll be walking on his footsteps today. This is basically the same corpus with variations, which makes it all the more interesting. You have to imagine very, very big villages counting up to 300 houses and 2,000, 3,000 people. And each of these villages are really a world in themselves. They actually, in ritual language, the word for village means universe. So it gives an idea. And the linguist, David Waters, who for the first time worked on the Kham language, and this is from him that these MAGA are also called Kham MAGA, this is from since his studies, he even says that each of these villages have their own dialect. There are about 50 Kham speakers who settled in the upper valleys of two districts in West Nepal, Rukum and Rolpa. And these two districts have become infamous recently because they've been elected by the Maoist leaders as their stronghold, as the heart of their guerrilla warfare. This is from these two districts that they've launched a guerrilla warfare for 10 years in Nepal. From 96 till 2006. And you can imagine that that's been a huge stress on the population. And I'll come back to this towards the end of the paper because it's changed the condition in which we're working. So shamanic literature, and Mark's presentation yesterday showed this very well, cannot be studied outside the performance. It is not a semantic block that can be extracted from the locus of the séance. And the best evidence of this, apart from the analysis we could hear yesterday, is that a shaman can neither sum up his songs nor dictate them. I tried this, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's not so much that a shaman would not like this for spiritual reason, but more because his memory doesn't work like this. It just can't. He cannot remember a song unless he sings it, and he cannot sing it for nothing, for no purpose. So ritual words are not gratuitous. They make the gods move, as a shaman said. They have power. At the beginning of my field work, and that will echo some of the things that Martin just said earlier, I did ask the most popular shaman in the village where I was, I did ask him to sing for me and my assistant only, so that it would be easier for me to record away from all the people who usually come and go, are usually oblivious of what is going on, and they laugh and they shout, and the kids are going around, and you can't even understand nothing, and even if you record it, it's very difficult. The drumming also, of course, doesn't help. So this shaman agreed, and the shaman in question, his name is Saha Chankri, he died, was not so happy initially about the idea of doing a kind of what I was asking him, but he agreed, and we did this kind of mock seance, so to speak, and he agreed to perform in a field close to the village with the necessary alcohol and sacrifices, blood sacrifices, because these are food for the spirits before being food for the people who perform, for the human beings. So the reason why he agreed, I think, is that he was eager to be recorded and to listen to his own voice. And this brings us back 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago, when tape recorders were still a rarity. Generally speaking, Saha also had a very strong personality. He was quite daring. He was curious of the outside world, very intelligent, ready to experience new things. And he was a little bit or very much of a local star. So he was flattered to be chosen for this recording. In any case, he did perform a short séance for me in these unconventional circumstances and pretended that I needed to have my soul or checked, my soul checked or something of the sort. I can't remember, but there was a purpose, a fake purpose, but there was one. A week later, he came by my house and told me that the day after the performance, he had lost a bull. The animal fell off the cliff. He didn't say that it was because he had performed a song in inappropriate circumstances. He left open the interpretation of the accident. However, an accident of this sort is a sign that something is wrong, and we never set up a mock séance again. I recorded in séance only, following him everywhere I could go with him. And I should say that fortunately, because I would have missed one of the fundamental characteristics of shamanic practices, that is reflexivity. And the chanted, what I mean by that is very simply that the chanted recitations of the shaman describe what the shaman is doing as he is doing it. And I'm going to give you a few examples of this reflexive aspect. One of the songs is always sung, whatever the séance is about. It's called The Nine Sisters, and it consists in the version I recorded, 1,626 lines exactly. It sets up fundamental categories that organize the world, day, night, the necessity of exogamous marriage, and the evil that it brings, that marriage brings into the patriline. More generally, the necessity of death to allow for life. In the end, it reflects on the mortal condition of the human beings and the part that the shaman has to play in this. Whilst one of the last episodes is particularly interesting for our purpose. The two wives of Ramapuransan, the ancestor of the shaman, the first shaman, the two wives of Ramapuransan insist that he reveals what will lead to his own death, so that they can protect him, so to say. Ramapuransan knows, however, that if he reveals the secret of his death, then the witches who are secretly listening will know how to proceed to cause his death. He hesitates for some time, but in the end he gives in and describes what will happen. He will be walking along the high ridge when nine birds, the nine witches that metamorphosed into nine birds, so the nine birds will fly off in front of him, will surprise him, and cause him to fall from the cliff. And it happens as he said, and Ramapuransan died. The point here is that Ramapuransan describes his destiny before it happens in the song. There is a narrative within the narrative, and through this narrative device, Ramapuransan is also a narrator, like the shaman who is singing the song. There is a juxtaposition between the mythical ancestor and the shaman who is performing. I'll give another example of this recurrent feature. In a certain ritual episode, the shaman is supposed to retrieve the patient's soul from the underworld by carrying the patient on his back. Mark spoke about that yesterday. And bouncing his back, he mimes his return from the underworld. As he does this, he sings the myth that relates how the mythic hero, another one, named Pudaran, brought back the heroine named Biselmi from the underworld. But the shaman doesn't say, I'm acting like the hero Pudaran with my patient who is like the heroine Biselmi. While he's carrying his patient, he sings, Pudaran brings back Biselmi. In this case, the shaman provides a sort of subtitle to the ritual act. This subtitling generates an oscillation in the spectator's perception of what is happening in the performance, since the action of the officiating shaman is also that of the mythic hero. The mythic world is brought down to the séance. We could also say that the specific event that the spectator is attending is endowed with a paradigmatic character. Yet another example of such oscillation in the ritual discourse is the interchangeable usage of first and third pronouns, the I of the shaman who is officiating and the he of Ramapuransan. The systematic use of parallelism make this even more striking when the two pronouns are used in the same lines, but commanded by parallelism. So it's I and he, or he and I. The grounding of the narrative into the occurrence of the ritual is further illustrated by a specific use of language. And, well, I apologize for those friends who already heard this a few months ago. Accessory songs, travel songs, and invocation provide the best illustration of this anchoring process. For instance, during the preliminary phase of a séance, the shaman's discourse consists of a series of direct addresses to the supernatural entities, such as greetings and orders, combined with an enumeration of proper names, names of ancestors, dead and alive, as it is said, of gods, that calls in the presence of these powerful characters in the course of the séance. Like, I give an example in English, listen, listen, gods, master who taught me, master who gave me knowledge, Father Chintirama, I am at your feet. Protect my head, protect my feet, stay on my forehead, stay on my shoulders. So, and the whole list of ancestors is given after that. There are enumerations of other names, such as clan names, names of the various quarters in the village, names of places along the daily itineraries of the villagers, etc. Names are not just words. They are specific and unique. They do not refer to anything else than what they are the identity of. And a description of the space that the shaman protects throughout his recitation, element by element, progressively builds up the specific ritual context in which he is acting and in which alone he has the power. The shaman sings songs devoted to the various elements that he needs during the séance. These are objects, plants, or animals that become like ritual partners, endowed with magical power through their identification with mythical prototypes. While he sings, he performs simple ritual gestures involving these elements, as if the paradigmatic models conveyed by the songs were being drawn onto them. For instance, he blows words into the beak of a chicken that whereby becomes the mythic naked bird that will help the shaman to retrieve the lost soul of the patient. Or he circulates a handful of grains around the head of the patient before the cereals are used for divination concerning the latter's condition. These gestures aim at transferring abstract entities such as power, illness, or the person's identity into objects or animals that can be in turn be suitably manipulated. In the Song of the Drum, one of the central features of the mythic corpus, the association between the mythic instrument and the ritual object is made through a series of transitional equations between the ancestral shaman and his drum, between the ancestral shaman and the shaman who is actually officiating, and finally between the mythical drum and the drum in the séance. Thanks. These equations are suggested by the description of activities that are broken down into their components almost ad infinitum. For example, the various steps in the search for the elements needed in the fabrication of the drum are combined with the traveling of the 9 assistants in the 4 directions in turn. I'll give an example where you see that also the words are used like object, or rather you have to give to the word the power it has in as an object. I'm going to quote 2 lines where the drum needs to have the power both to reject bad spirits, that is called sepaserum, and to conform and be propitious to Rama Puransan, Rama Ranju, as he is called in this. So he will say Sepa, so the bad spirit, ma gorgor, means the drum does not drive away the bad spirit. But it will say in the other line, Rama, it means the good one, I mean the ancestor of the shaman, Rama Magorgor, means Rama, the drum does not, is not propitious to the answer to the shaman. It means exactly the same expression is used for two different activity. One is driving away the bad spirit. The other one is, on the contrary, being propitious to the shaman. So the only way to solve the paradox or the contradiction in the translation is to give to the word the power of the object. So these literary devices bring about a transfer of magical power by means of what Fraser might have called contagion magic. But here words are being used in order to transfer power to the object along a chain formed by their close juxtaposition. There is hardly any grammatical link between the words that tend to be listed. The consequence of this specific use of language is the singularization of the ritual speech in opposition to the generalizing value of ordinary language. With a high degree of indexicality, it remains embedded in its context of enunciation. Ritual language supplies the intermediary link between the abstract definition of the world and acting upon the world. Well, I think I've given enough evidence that the narratives need to be recorded in context, and better even than only recorded, filmed, if you want to be able to analyze actually the relationship between words and actions. I haven't filmed all this. I only recorded it. Now, I said that the Maoists banned shamanic performances. They didn't do that immediately. They did that after a few years when they thought that they had secured their position in the villages and they had established their what they called people-village government. They then wanted to educate people. They wanted to educate the population and mainly eradicate superstitions in the name of the progressive science. They actually had exactly the same arguments as the missionaries or even the people who are trying to, development people. I mean, these are the same kind of reasoning. Shamans are charlatans. Shamanic seance is unnecessary, costly. Blood sacrifices are barbaric practices, etc. The thing is that the Maoist could be physically threatening, and for years, shamans hardly performed. There was no big gathering anymore of shamans who can be up to 20. In a big village, there can be up to 20 shamans, and it is necessary for them to be there. It's actually deeply rooted into the social organization. Each lineage in the village where I work, each village having to provide, in certain circumstances, one shaman. So no big gathering of 20 shamans or so, no drumming, no big sacrifices, or at least sacrifices that would be visible, because there was secret seances in the houses, I was told. At the same time that the Maoist banned shamanic performances, they were playing the ethnic card. And they were searching a sort of legitimacy from the pure Maga who would represent natural communism, unspoiled by Hinduism and the feudal caste society. Well, we are in presence of a clear case of cultural politics in which the Maga would provide the Maoist and their nationalist propaganda with a kind of seal of authenticity, so to speak. So we are in a kind of contradictory situation where the Maoists praise the Maga culture. They even created a completely new district that was constituted by only the Kham-speaking villages. At the same time that they ban what is at the heart of the Maga culture. And this introduced Of course, within 10 years, I mean, nothing was forgotten of this tradition, and it took up more recently, and although I haven't done, you know, study in depth about exactly what's happening now in long séances, I guess that the songs are the same. I don't know. This would have to be investigated. But this introduced, nevertheless, a distance in the way people understand and experience what they used to do without thinking. I mean, more precisely, I shouldn't say that, because they always think about what they do and they always express doubts, and we could speak about that. I mean, it never goes without saying, in a way, but shamanic seances were not an issue. They started to think of their shamanic practice as a kind of asset and even a commodity, something that they could use for other purposes, such as making them better known on the ethnic map, for instance, or most obviously for tourism business. And this is a process that many among us anthropologists have been documenting, and most probably most of you have experienced. But, and this is just to finish and come back on the main theme of this conference on collecting and transmission, this is what I'd like to suggest, is that ritual literature is a little specific in this respect. It is not like a tale or lullaby, like we had this fascinating project yesterday in Tibet where, you know, Gerald was trying to give people the means to the local population to collect their own patrimony. It's a little specific in the sense that the ritual language convey power. It's not like lullaby or just a simple tale. And I wonder whether in these specific circumstances, a little bit what I was suggesting earlier, the outsider, which I am, should intervene in that. Specifically also, because in the context of the Kammaga, the Maoists have been monopolizing the politicization of the people, and they haven't been, much less extent, under the spell of ethnic activists so far. So I wouldn't like to end on this kind of nostalgic or sad note, and I'd like to invite you to imagine the novel or the epic that the son of Saha Jankri, whom I spoke of at the beginning of this paper. So imagine the epic that the son of Saha Jankri or his grandson may write in the future, like others did after the tradition of their forefathers had died. Thank you.